The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Now we're on our Jewish books tour. We've now reached a stage, and I gave you those charts yesterday. You won't need them, but they're there. Really of books. And until now we've discussed the Bible and the prophets and the Talmud. Now we're going to get into a specific book, or a specific author, I should say, which is Maimonides. There were many medieval commentators. And it's interesting that I chose Maimonides, and you can imagine that I had a lot of dilemma as to which and what books. You know, you only have so many classes to give in a course like this, and there's so many important Jewish books. So I don't want you to think that this is it, but at the same time, to choose those that I feel that you will inevitably come across that are central in Judaism. One of the reasons, by the way, that I didn't choose to study Rashi is simply because Rashi is a commentary on books and didn't really write, for the most part, his own books. Although you could argue that his commentary to a book is a book. I also felt that we get a taste of Rashi, as we did yesterday, when we study Chumash, when we study Bible. Who is the Rambam? Why is the Rambam important? What do I stand to gain from the Rambam? First of all, just by way of a biography, the Rambam lived, he was born in 1135. He spanned the 12th century. He was born actually in Spain, and he was exiled from Spain as a boy, from Cordoba, as a result of the wars between the Moors, Muslims, and the Christians. He ended up eventually in Egypt. He was quite a talented individual. First of all, he became a doctor. He was a physician. And he wasn't just any physician. I mean, as it was in those days, to become a doctor was quite an incredible thing. He became the physician of his time. He was the physician of Salah ad-Din, Saladin, of Crusader battle fame from this area. And we actually have some of his writings, some of his letters, both concerning his medical experience and concerning his day. And to this day, there's actually a sefer known as the Medical Advice of the Rambam. And it's interesting that many of the remedies and formulas and potions that he had are now very much in sync with homeopathic medicine. And there's actually a whole leaning in certain communities to begin to go back to some of the advice that the Rambam had in terms of medicine. He, by the way, very much believed in the importance of a healthy body. At a certain point in one of his works of halakha, he says that every person has an obligation to sleep 8 hours a day. And that minimally, if a person sleeps 6 hours a day, he can get away with it, but not less than that. Now that's a little difficult because he writes at a certain point of himself that he used to sleep 2 hours a day, but he was good at giving advice. But he says that a person is supposed to take care of his body. He felt that a person should exercise every day, that that was not considered pulling you away from mitzvot and Torah study, but rather that you were exercising as a vehicle to be able to serve God. And that a healthy body would allow for a healthy mind, etc. And that a body, like everything else in this world, is a gift given to us by God, and therefore we have a responsibility to take care of it. Now, in addition to the fact that he was a physician, he eventually became quite well known as a rabbi and as a philosopher. And people came to him day and night with their questions and their difficulties and their problems. He ended up living in Fez in Egypt. Most fascinatingly was that he was a prolific author. And when you look at the different things that he accomplished in his life, it's amazing that he was able to find the time to do all that he did. By the way, he's buried in Tiberias, in Tveria, and you can visit his grave. He wrote a number of great works. Now, there's a debate. One of the great works that he wrote was called the Perush HaMishnayot, a commentary to the entire Mishnah. We discussed the Mishnah yesterday, the oral tradition, six sections. He wrote a commentary to the entire Mishnah. Now, you saw yesterday we studied one Mishnah, and we began to discuss it. And we didn't even cover the tip of the iceberg on that Mishnah. So you could imagine that writing a commentary on the entire Mishnah must have been an incredible work. All the more so when you read both his introduction to the beginning of the Mishnah and his concluding comments at the end of the entire Mishnah. He wrote this mostly on the run. When he was exiled with his family as a boy from Cordoba, he felt it was very difficult to study, but he wanted to find some way to devote himself regularly every day to study of Torah. So this goal of writing a commentary was what kept him going. 3 years they lived in a cave. And he completed this commentary mostly while he lived in that cave. He had no library, to the best of my knowledge. He had no great rabbis to ask questions of. He simply studied the Mishnah and wrote his comments. And there are instances where some of his later writings contradict his commentary on the Mishnah, possibly because he completed the commentary of the Mishnah at such a young age. There's a divergence of opinions as to exactly what age he finished it. One of the accepted opinions is that he finished his commentary to the Mishnah at the age of 17. So be depressed. 17 years old, commentated the entire Mishnah. He wrote a book called The Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. Guide to the Perplexed was a unique book in certain ways in its time. It dealt with all of the great philosophical issues in Judaism. He was quite outspoken in some of his opinions. For example, he was one of the first rabbis who believed and proved, based on the Talmud, that when the Bible goes so far as to say, the hand of God, the face of God, that it doesn't mean literally that God had a hand, but that it's an idea. And this is something that's pretty much accepted in Judaism today, but in the time of the Mishnah, it's not so clear that some of the rabbis didn't think that God had the capability to appear in the guise of a hand. There were other issues that made him quite outspoken in terms of his perception of the world to come, in terms of his perception with vis-a-vis non-Jews and their ability to be in the world to come, in terms of his perception of, and this was the most controversial, of the value of secular science and philosophy. I mean, you see quite clearly that he studied the works of Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and he incorporated Aristotelian thought very much into his writings, albeit that he picked up where he believed Aristotle left off. He didn't feel that Aristotle went far enough. This was a radical idea, because until that time, Greek philosophy was considered beyond the pale. The Greeks, after all, persecuted the Jews, and Greek philosophy was considered the worship of the human body, idolatry, paganism, was considered almost antithetical to Judaism. So to be able to glean ethical value, philosophical value, from Greek philosophy was a very radical thought. The books of the Rambam were burned in the Rambam's time. But eventually, the Or Sameach of Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, who was a rabbi in Dvinsk at the end of the 1800s, put it well. He said, you can burn truth, you can fight truth, you can deny truth, you can hide from truth. But if it's truth, it'll never disappear. And eventually you'll have to accept it. And that's exactly what happened with the Rambam. The power of this book, of the Moreh Nevuchim, was such that you couldn't sweep it under the table. The people would not be denied. And I will tell you, by the way, a couple of things about this book. First of all, it was written in Arabic. And it was first translated into English. And the English translation, for various reasons that I won't go into, is probably more accurate in some ways than the Hebrew. So that this is one of the few books I can think of where there's actually a value to studying it in English. And as a matter of fact, I'm now going through again. I mean, I haven't gone through it in years. I originally learned it in Hebrew, and then I learned it in English. And I saw that there was a huge difference. And now, in going through it again in the Hebrew, I'm actually using an English translation that I think is very good to go back to determine certain points. And when I find a divergence, unlike, let's say, for example, the Bible, I'm not so sure that the Hebrew translation is really the accurate translation. And by the way, go a stage further, I would say that the reason that it was written in Arabic, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, was because the Rambam was not interested in creating a Platonic text. He was interested in having a text that could deal with the issues that people had. And therefore he wanted it to be in the language of the people. Fascinating idea. The Moreh Nevuchim, by the way, if I had to suggest a way to study Rambam, Maimonides, to get an intricate and a familiar idea of who the Rambam was and what he meant, as well as studying an incredible book, which is just essential in terms of where we're at and developing a relationship with Judaism, this would be it. The Moreh Nevuchim is a book, it's not an easy book, and you really have to think, but it's translated completely into English, and it's an incredible work. And you can also get a sense that for the most part, although you'll find points that Maimonides will make, that other great commentators will disagree with,
As a rule today, and we'll get into why in a minute, as a rule today, if you're quoting the Rambam, you know you're within the bounds of tradition. You can't go wrong if you follow the Rambam. It could be that other commentators disagree with him, it could be that our ruling doesn't follow the Rambam in certain instances, but if you're following the Rambam, you're safe. And it's a very powerful book. When you read a book, right, so what do you usually do? You start the book. Who reads the introduction to a book, right? But of course, who wrote the introduction? The author. And the author wrote his book and wanted you to begin with his introduction. So why it is that we very often skip the introduction is an interesting question. I'm a little fanatical about reading introductions. I think it's a very valuable thing to do. I'll even read an introduction to a dictionary. If you read Marcus Jastrow's dictionary on Aramaic, it's an incredible, incredible work. And when you study, when you begin studying Talmud, so Talmud is in Aramaic, and it's very difficult for people who don't speak Aramaic. So Marcus Jastrow, a professor who called himself secular, if such a thing could be, it was a magnificent thing what he did, going through the entire Talmud and many other works in Aramaic. And he has a huge volume, I have a copy in my office, if anyone wants to see it, of an Aramaic-English dictionary. So he has an introduction. That's like 20, 30 pages. And he goes through how he did this. How he translated Aramaic, how he came up with the works. It's a fascinating introduction. It gives you a whole different perception, as well as telling you how the book works, because it's a very difficult book to use. Same is true with the Rambam. The Rambam writes an introduction which is as long as any one of the sections of his book. And if you don't read the introduction when you study the Mor Nevuchim, which unfortunately many people skip, you really don't understand what the Mor Nevuchim wants of you. The Mor Nevuchim meaning, again, the guide to the perplexed. And he has a few different sections, and fascinatingly enough, the first section of the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, which, by the way, was written in response to a number of difficulties and questions that he had in his time, the first section really is a dictionary in and of itself. He goes through terminology. He says, if we're going to talk Torah, and we're going to have a philosophical discussion, we have to make sure that we're on the same wavelength. If I'm talking about God, and you and I have a complete different perception of what God is, then how can we have a discussion? So he says the Torah uses all sorts of words. And we misinterpret those words. I'll give you an example. The Torah says, Vayivra Elokim et ha'adam betzalmo, betzalem Elokim bara oto, zachar nekeva bara oto. God created man in his image, whatever that means. There's another verse that says, Na'aseh adam betzalmeinu kidmuteinu. We're going to make man in our image, whatever that means. So what does it mean, an image? What's a tzalem? What does that mean? Does that mean that when I get upstairs and I want to look for God, that if a tiger comes to me and says, I'm God, I'll say, ha, no, because you don't look like a man. So I'm looking for someone, a man or a woman, that's God, or maybe both. So the Rambam says that's not what it means. A tzelem is not a blueprint. A tavnit is a blueprint. A tzelem is something very different. It's an image, it's an idea. There's a common ground between something, the idea, the essence of man that is common to God. In other words, there is something God-like in our essence. Mysticism might go so far as to say that God's self is contained in my essence. And I have to find that. Now, if I haven't had that discussion, and I don't know what that means, well, then that simple word can undermine my ability to understand any discussion the Rambam will have. So that's the first thing he does. And he goes through a whole list of terms. And just from that perspective, I mean, I keep the Mor Nevuchim at home very near my desk. And whenever I'm studying something and I come across that type of word, so I'll go and I'll look it up in the Rambam. What does the Rambam say about that word? It's very easy to find because there's a table of contents, which is actually written by the Rambam also, if I'm not mistaken, in his introduction. And you can find where he talks about a given item. And you can get an idea. So that's the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim. By the way, you shouldn't misunderstand. When I say that the Rambam writes a commentary to the Mishnah, we're talking very deep. And if, as I mentioned yesterday, there are different parts of the Mishnah, there are parts of the Mishnah which are agadic, right? Stories, ethics, philosophy, and parts which are halachic, law and detail. So that's reflected in the Rambam's commentary as well. And he deals with both types of Mishnah. For example, one of the most beautiful commentaries around on ethics of the fathers, on Pirkei Avot, which is all midrashic, all agadic, is the Rambam's commentary. It's magnificent. It's incredible. And at the same time, if you want to study the laws of how to build the Beit HaMikdash, so the Rambam is indispensable. As a matter of fact, there's a section of the Mishnah called Perek Chelek, which is the 10th chapter of the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, the laws of the Sanhedrin of the High Court. And it begins with the statement, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelek Le'olam Haba. All of Israel have a portion in the world to come. I think we talked about this Mishnah once, right? Yes? No? Getting that special look I get from students sometimes, like, right? It tells me I might be on a different wavelength. But this is a very difficult Mishnah. And the Mishnah says that every Jew has a portion in the world to come. Now that's a very optimistic, very wonderful Mishnah. And everybody quotes that Mishnah. And you'll find that Mishnah at the beginning of Ethics of the Fathers. And that's a very difficult problem. Why am I starting a work of Jewish ethics with the statement that everybody gets into the Garden of Eden? That everybody gets into the world to come? Because if everybody already is going to get in there, then great, I don't need to do anything ethical. I'm already there. So that's an interesting question. But nobody quotes the second half of the Mishnah, which is, now I'm going to tell you who doesn't get into the world to come. And that's very difficult. There's one Mishnah that says, someone who embarrasses his fellow human being in public. Hamalbin pnei chaviro barabim. If someone embarrasses a friend in public, ein lo chelek l'olam haba, he has no portion to the world to come. Fascinating. If you desecrate Shabbat, you can still get into the world to come. If you're eating pig your entire life, you can still get into the world to come. But if you embarrass your fellow human being, and it's interesting, the word there is malbin, to whiten. Because when you embarrass somebody, the blood drains from their face, and it's like they become white. And the Talmud equates that with murder. You can spill a person's blood physically, and you can spill a person's blood psychologically, and we know how true that is. How much damage you can do to another human being. So the Rambam discusses that. And he has a whole introduction to that chapter of Sanhedrin. And in that introduction, he comes up with 13 principles of faith. Have you ever heard of the 13 principles of faith of Maimonides? And there's much discussion. I mean, that's a book in and of itself. And there are whole books written about the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. You can even find them, and if you're curious later, I'll show you. You can find them in the prayer book. And there are many difficult questions. How does this work? What are these 13 principles? Are these 13 principles that are necessary for me to be a Jew? Do I have to believe in these 13 principles of faith in order to be a Jew, in order to be a practicing Jew, whatever that means? Are they just tools that I can use to combat other issues? Was the Rambam writing this in response to the tremendous difficulties that the Jews were having in responding to Christian anti-Semitism, as well as to Islamic attempts at conversion? Very difficult how you look at this. And when you look at these principles of faith, it's an incredible thing that the Rambam was able to take all of Judaism and break it down into 13 pieces of information. And to say, if you want to know where to start, here's where you start. And it's fascinating to study. And by the way, it's a magnificent way to sort of gradually get your feet wet in Jewish philosophy and Jewish ideals before you get deep, deep into ritual. Rabbi Arya Kaplan has a little pamphlet. It's a very, very easy book to read. He quotes the original text of the 13 Principles of Faith in the Rambam's introduction to the 10th portion in the 10th chapter in the Mishnah of Sanhedrin. And then he quotes the Ani Ma'amin. Have you ever seen in the Siddur, right, for example, one of them you might know, Ani Ma'amin be'emunah shleima, I believe with complete faith, b'viat Mashiach, in the coming of Mashiach, coming of a king who will be anointed and return to the house of David, v'afal pi shi'it mameya, and even though he may tarry, even though he may delay, in kol zeh achakelo, with all this I will wait for him, b'chol yom sheyavo, on whatever day he'll come. Now we, today, we don't appreciate this. But to be writing that in the 12th century, post-Crusades, well, that's not so simple. That you believe that the Jewish people are going to be redeemed and we're going to come home to the land of Israel. That's incredible. And the Rambam's 13 principles, which are paragraphs, were put into sentences in the format of Ani Ma'amin. I believe there's a God, I believe God is one, I believe God, you know, etc. And you go through the principles of the Rambam in this commentary to the Mishnah, and you begin to get a sense that he's developing a process. That it's really very difficult to be at stage 6 without being at stage 1. And you know, this is a problem people have. Let's say that I'd like to discover what Judaism is. How do you do that? How would you read the whole Bible? I mean, 15 years later, maybe you get an idea, but how does that, I mean, you walk out of here, you say, okay, I see there's a value, there's a beauty. What do I do with that? Where do I begin? And how do I inculcate it gradually? Because you know, I've told you before, I think that there's a tremendous value in doing things gradually. And you know, by the way, and I honestly believe, although here you could take me to task for this, I honestly believe that the Rambam believed in what I told you before. In other words, I told you once that I don't have an agenda. I don't think that there's a goal that you come here and you're supposed to do X. If we have a discussion about Shabbat, it's not because I think you should be celebrating Shabbat. It's because I'm sharing with you the beauty of Shabbat. You very much get a sense of that in the Rambam. The Rambam, you know, he had a belief as to what ideally a Jew could do. But that was really a reflection of the Rambam's belief that there was a beauty that a Jew could discover within the tradition of Torah, and here is how you go about discovering it. So for example, the first principle is the principle that there is a God, that there is some manifest force guiding the world. And the second principle is that that God is one. Now if you think about it, that's an interesting thing. Let's say for example, I say that there's a God, God created the world. I look back at the beginning of time, the Big Bang. I can't imagine what caused that bang to occur. I don't have a problem with the Big Bang per se, but who's the banger? So say, okay, there must be some force that created the world, some God. But let's say there's two gods. So there's two gods. One God in the day, one God in the night. Why do I need to believe in one God? Maybe the idolaters are right. The idolaters had no problem with the difficulty that an atheist might have with science, which is that I'm analyzing the how-to, but I don't know the why-for. Well, the idolater didn't have that problem. Of course there's a God. There's just 19 of them. So what's the problem with having many gods? Why do you have to say that that God, which is another principle, isn't physical? Ain't no goof. That God can't have a physical essence. Why not? God's unlimited. God can be physical. So the Rambam believed that ultimately, in order for me to have a relationship with God, in order for me to be able to accept that God is so far above me, that Hashem is so far beyond me, both in terms of the appreciation that I have to have, in terms of the love that I should feel emanating from God, in terms of the desire to have a relationship with God, that God is so far beyond me to a certain extent, right? In order to have that, God has to be unlimited. And it makes sense that if there's a God, God is unlimited. Because if God is limited, well, then why worship God? And in order for God to be unlimited, so that precludes all sorts of possibilities. By definition, God has to be one. Because if God isn't one, if there are two gods, then God is limited. Because this God isn't that God. And by the way, if there are two gods, God has to be physical. So the minute I say that there can't be two gods, then there can't be a physical God. Or I should say vice versa. If God is physical, God has to be limited. Because God is here and He's not there. That's the definition. That's our definition of physical. I once had a student say, okay, so let's say God is physical, but He isn't here and not there. So I say, fine, so you're talking about a different type of physical. That's not the type of physical we're talking about. By the way, that's why the Rambam says as well that you have to believe that God is involved in the world. Because if, in order for God not to be involved in the world, then God has to not know what's going on. Because the minimal amount of involvement that we're talking about is that God knows everything that's going on. Well, if God doesn't know everything that's going on, there's something God doesn't know. God is limited. And by the way, what gets really deep is that later in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Rambam does exactly the opposite. He says, now that you've accepted, later in the commentary of the Mishnah, but in the Guide to the Perplexed as well, now that you've accepted how unlimited God is, and how far beyond you God is, now comes the real challenge, to be able to discover how close God is. How much God isn't beyond your reach. How easy it is to find God. That's not an easy thing. To be able to, you know, I'll give you an example. Torah tells us that the Ten Commandments, right, are divided up into two parts, right? Between man and God and between man and man. The section of the Torah that deals between man and God concerns the relationship that I have with God. And yet if I look at those first five commandments, so most of them make sense. I am the Lord thy God, you know, no idolatry, don't take God's name in vain. There's one that doesn't make sense. Respect your parents. Why is respecting your parents in the section of the Ten Commandments of the Aseret HaDibrot that concerns my relationship with God? So the rabbis say, because your relationship with your parent is a reflection of your relationship with God. Because you can learn to appreciate God by learning to appreciate your parents. Because every aspect of your relationship with your parents can be a microcosm of how you can relate to God. And I'll give you an example. That's exactly what we're talking about. There are different types of parents. Sometimes a parent is so removed, so above, the stern, imposing father, that it becomes difficult for me to develop a close relationship with that parent. Sometimes a parent is so close, so much a buddy, that it's difficult for me to remember that really they're my parent. We live in a generation where we freely disagree with our parents, discuss with our parents, argue with our parents, tell our parents off. So it's very easy for us to forget that this is my parent. Previous generations had the opposite problem sometimes. I mean, if dad says something, if the father said something, you quaked in your boots. Can you discover both? And I think we have different challenges in our life, depending on what type of parent we have. If we have the one, we have a challenge to find the other, and vice versa. So that's very much what the Rambam is doing in his commentary to the Mishnah, and in the Guide to the Perplexed. There was, however, and by the way, I should mention another very important work of the Rambam, which is the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Commandments. Imagine for the moment that you hear that there's all these commandments, and let's say you've had a discussion, and you say, okay, commandment is not just an obligation, but it's an opportunity, and it's a celebration, and developing a relationship with God. So where do I find them? How do I do that? So you say, okay, great, you know, I'll open the Bible. It's all in here, right? So we discussed this already at the beginning of this course, you know, you start reading and reading and reading, all about Genesis, all about Noah, all about there's no commandments. So then somebody tells you, okay, go to Leviticus 19. Well, Leviticus 19, Kedoshim, so you'll find like 50 plus odd, you know, commandments in that portion, so that's great. But then what do those commandments mean? How do they work? How do I know if I'm obligated to fulfill them or not? How do I sift through the different types of commandments and understand what their implication is for me? How do I reach a stage where I can develop in my relationship with commandments, with the mitzvot, stage by stage? So the Rambam writes a book called Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Commandments, in which he lists all of the 613 commandments one at a time. Fascinating book. There are commentaries written on the book. Sometimes it seems almost obvious. And sometimes one begins to consider it. Take, for example, the mitzvah not to steal. What does that mean, not to steal? We take it for granted. What does that mean? When am I stealing? When am I not stealing? Does something have to belong to somebody else in order for me to be stealing? Can I steal for myself? Can I steal time? Can I steal sleep? Can I steal a person's reputation? And all sorts of other mitzvot. And the Rambam goes as far as to discuss what mitzvot are biblical and what mitzvot are rabbinic. Because after all, if a mitzvah is commanded to us by the rabbis, then there are all sorts of differences with regards to how I relate to that mitzvah. I'll give you just one example, and no one should misinterpret this to mean that we take the mitzvot, the obligations that are given to us by the rabbis, as less serious, because of course there is a biblical commandment to listen to the rabbis. So it's like, you know, the Torah was clever enough to create a catch-22. But nonetheless, I'll give you an example. If I have a safek, if I have a doubt, right? If I don't know whether or not something is a transgression or not, I'll give you an example. There's a biblical command not to eat meat and milk that are cooked together. Right? If I take some cheese, put it on a hamburger, cook it together, so everybody knows that's a cheeseburger and it wasn't high on the rabbi's list of do's on Yom Kippur afternoon. Okay. What about if I make a chicken cheeseburger? Take a piece of chicken. Put some cheese on it. Well, it's not meat, or is it meat? It's chicken. It's different from meat somehow, right? So in fact, chicken, the Talmud debates whether or not chicken is meat. So the rabbis say, well, even though biblically it doesn't seem to be meat, we rule that it's meat. For various reasons. Not least of which being, it's going to be very hard for people to remember not to eat a cheeseburger if we tell them that they can eat a chicken cheeseburger. Right? Okay. So chicken is meat. But chicken is rabbinic meat. It's not biblical meat. Now let's say, for example, that I don't know if something is a cheeseburger or not. Or let's say a piece of cheeseburger fell into my souffle. Right? So because I don't know if it's really there or not, I have what's called a safek. I'm in doubt. When I'm in doubt about a rabbinic concern, I'm much more lenient. When I'm in doubt concerning a biblical concern, I'm much more stringent. And that makes a lot of sense. If the rabbis enacted a rabbinic commandment to prevent you from reaching a biblical commandment, so then the very fact that you're having a doubt about this commandment means that you have that legitimate concern already for the biblical commandment. So that makes sense. So that's the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvot. And that's a very important book. By the way, just as an aside, I will tell you, just in the interest of giving you practical and wonderful tools, the Chafetz Chaim of Rosal Meir Kagan, Rosh Yeshiva, well, he wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva, he was actually a grocery store owner, but he was such a great Talmud Chacham that everybody considered him, you know, this tremendous rabbi. He wrote very important works, and the one that made him famous was a book that he published anonymously. You know how it is. If you run from fame, it usually finds you. If you run after it, you never really get it. But or honor, at least. But he wrote a book called Nitzor L'Shemcha, which is about how to fulfill all the mitzvot concerning slander. And he felt that if a person could eat a cheeseburger every day and never speak a word of slander, they'd be far, far better off than you know, staying away from cheeseburgers and forgetting about the slander. There are over 40 different prohibitions and commandments that a person can fulfill in a given day by not slandering. That's tremendous when you think about it. He also wrote a book, well, whatever. So that was the Chafetz Chaim. So one of the books that the Chafetz Chaim wrote, and this is 19th century, was a book called the Sefer HaMitzvot HaKatzar. The short Sefer HaMitzvot. The short version of the Sefer HaMitzvot, in which he details those mitzvot that are applicable to us today. For example, he leaves out all the mitzvot that are concerning the temple, and all the mitzvot that are concerning priests, and all the mitzvot that are concerning how to take tithes in the land of Israel, because he lived in Poland. And he wrote this book as a guide to Jewish boys who were going off to serve in the Russian army. Because when you went off to the Russian army, you were drafted not for a year or two or three, you were drafted for 20 years. And it was basically a recipe for disaster spiritually. So this still is around today, and it's actually been published in English. They have those little, ever see those little Feldheim books, the little pocket books? You can go into the Moriah bookstore. As a matter of fact, this is now a window on a window on a window, or a tangent on a tangent on a tangent. As a matter of fact, if you haven't done this yet, you should. You should go into Moriah's farm store here, the bookstore right across the way, just to browse. Just to get a sense of what books are out there, what different Jewish books. It's a wonderful thing to do during the break. Right? And he's got this pocketbook, and it's a great way to get a picture of mitzvot. He has a paragraph on each mitzvah. This is what the mitzvah means. This is who's obliged. Men are, women aren't, men aren't, whatever it might be. Anyway, so that's the Rambam on the Sefer HaMitzvot, on the Book of Mitzvot. Now, we get to the magnum opus. And I give you all this by way of introduction because I'd really like to take a chance to explore how the Rambam did this. The Rambam wrote a book called the Yad HaChazaka, which literally means a strong hand. Yad is a hand. The reason he called it the Yad HaChazaka was because the letters Yud and Dalet are numerically equivalent to 14. Yud is the 10th letter, Dalet is the 4th. And he wrote 14 books, which he incorporated in this work. And what he did in this work was quite incredible. Imagine for the moment that you decide that you want to develop a relationship with Judaism, with God, with yourself, whatever. So you want to pick a particular area and begin to study it. Take, for example, I don't know, the laws of prayer or the laws of Shabbat. So you figure, okay, you're living now in the year 1100. So there is no Rambam because the Rambam didn't live yet. So what do you have to do? Well, you figure, I'll open up the Talmud. And there's a tractate in the Talmud called Masechet Shabbat, the tractate of Shabbat. And I look up this tractate and it will tell me what the laws of Shabbat are, right? Great. Except there's one problem. First problem is that the Talmud is in Aramaic. Well, that makes it a little difficult. Second problem is that the Talmud, the tractate in Shabbat, is over 130 pages of Aramaic. And when I say a page, I mean two sides. That's 260 sides. A very difficult exegesis. Questions and answers and how to deal with them and how to attack them and what to deal with. It's not clear at all in the Talmud what the final ruling is. There's a debate. And Rabbi Eliezer says this, and Rabbi Meir says that, and Rabbi Akiva says this, and the Chachamim say that. And then we go on to, well, who's right? What's the rule? I just want to know what the rule is. Don't tell me the whole discussion philosophically about what to do. And then, of course, there's another problem, which is that not all the laws of Hilchot Shabbat are contained in the Tractate of Shabbat. You can find laws on Shabbat in the Tractate of Passover, in the Tractate of Brachot, in the Tractate, all over the Talmud. So, of course, you've got a very easy solution. And this will be the correct solution. Study the entire Talmud. No problem. If you study the entire Talmud, then you'll know the laws of Shabbat. If, of course, you remember the entire Talmud that you studied. So that's great. Except that it doesn't work anymore. And by the time the Rambam was writing his work in the Middle Ages, Jews were not studying the entire Talmud. It may well be in the time of the Talmud, and this is an interesting historical debate. I get into these things. When they wrote the Talmud, did actually all the Jews then go and study the entire Talmud? Like, did you walk around the street and go to the grocery store and next to you was a guy who knew the entire Talmud by heart? Were they on an entirely different level? Which is one opinion historically. The other opinion historically is that we write down the methods by which they arrived at their rulings, but they just taught the people the rulings orally. Anyway, so in the time of the Middle Ages, you had a big problem. So the Rambam did an incredible thing. The Rambam had an encyclopedic mind. You can see from his works that he knew the entire Talmud, the Gemara, the Mishnah, all of the Midrashim, the entire Torah, the prophets, by heart. He must have. Because when you read his works, he quotes from all of them in all of his discussions. He had no computer. Libraries then were not what they are now. He had very few books at his disposal, most probably. Although you could argue he might have had a nice library simply because he was the doctor of the Sultan. And he wrote a book called the Yad HaChazaka, in which he organized all of halakha, all of Jewish law, from the entire Talmud, and by the way, from the Midrashic halakha, which is another discussion as well, into sections. So now you can look up the 30-some-odd chapters of the laws of Shabbat, and you can study them. And you can go through them, and you can know all of the laws of Shabbat. Or at least you can be aware of all the issues. And it's even today, when it's more complicated, and you can't just read the Rambam and know what the ruling is, at the very least, if you've studied the Rambam, you know what all the questions are. That's an incredible thing. I remember when I was studying to be a rabbi. So we're going to get to the code of Jewish law in our next class in Jewish books. This is a very difficult thing. You know, I mean, I'm going to go and I'm going to be a rabbi, and people are going to ask me questions. How am I supposed to know the answers? I don't have 30 years to sit and study all this. So I remember I had a discussion once with a person who I Rav Lichtenstein, one of the tremendous Torah scholars that I know. He's not one of the greatest that I know. Walking, living Torah, I think I discussed him once with you. And I asked him this question. He said, look, obviously you should try to be able to resolve all these issues as much as you can. He said, but at least make it a goal to know all the questions. That's your first goal. Know all the questions. He said, your second goal is know where to find the answers to those questions. That's what he said to me. Now, I want you to know that where to find isn't always a book. Sometimes it's a person. If you have a Rav and you respect that Rav and you have a close relationship with him, you know that there are certain types of rabbis who can answer certain types of questions. For example, Rav Lichtenstein is one of the world's greatest experts on Rambam, on Maimonides. When I'm studying Rambam and I have a difficulty, I know that's the person I call. When I have a difficulty in educational issues that result with discussions, let's say, with a student who comes from, you know, less background, whatever that might be, the type of person I might meet here. So I know that the person that I can talk to is Rabbi Aaron or Rabbi Riskin. You know, you have to know who your, where your books are. You have written books and you have living books. If I know I have a certain type of question halachically on Shabbat, I don't always have a rabbi to ask. So I look up the Mishnah Berurah, I look up the Chafetz Chaim's work on the laws of Shabbat, I know where I can find it. And I know I won't go too broad. So now all of a sudden there was a recipe for where to look. And every person can do that. And by the way, this entire work is translated into English. So that's incredible. This book became so successful, this Rambam, first of all, that when a Jew in the traditional world says a Rambam, this is what he's talking about. It's called the Rambam, right? They tell of Soloveitchik once, and I heard this from someone who was there. He once went to a parlor meeting. He was asked to give a class in a person's home. And he went to this meeting. Whenever he was giving a shiur, he was giving a class. And Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, one of the greatest minds of our day, tremendous Torah scholar from a long line of Torah scholars. He was really the founder and mentor, perhaps, of Yeshiva University. Thousands of students who today are in Jewish education and rabbis. There's no doubt that certainly in the Orthodox and certainly in the modern Orthodox world, that ultimately the educational legacy that he left behind is bar none. I don't know of anyone else who succeeded in the way that he did. And he was a tremendous Torah scholar. I mean, he was a walking encyclopedia as well. And I was privileged to hear some of his classes. I have a few of them on tape. So he walked into this house and he was giving a shiur and he says to the host, you know, do you have a Rambam? Right? I'm going to quote something. Do you have a Rambam? So the host said, oh no, I don't think I have one. So Rav Soloveitchik, because I guess it was such an instinct, he said, a Jewish home without a Rambam? How could you not have a Rambam in your house? What do you mean you don't have a toilet? How could you not have a toilet? You have to build a house, you have to have a toilet, you have to have a sink, you have to have a Rambam! That's how a Rambam became in a Jewish home. You're going to see, by the way, that the entire system of Jewish law, the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch that we'll discuss in our next class, is patterned after this Rambam. So I want to now discuss with you, by the way, just as an aside, okay, this entire book is translated into English. They have, I forget what they're called, Rambam La'am in easy Hebrew, easy English. You can get now books, I forget who publishes them, but if you're really curious and you decide you want to pursue it, so let me know, and you can walk into Mariah's farm store and ask them. I'm sure they'll show you a copy. And like I said, valuable thing to do. So look at this Rambam, and by the way, I'll tell you one last thing, and this is a yeshivish trick, right, is that there are 14 books, right, and you can get it in 14 volumes, you know, or 6 volumes, whatever. When I was bar mitzvah, I got this big, beautiful Rambam, and I remember getting it and thinking, oh, God, great, another set of books, a Rambam, what about a basketball? But of course, years later, I appreciated, you know, what a gift it was. I actually once found a Shita Mekubetzet, which is a 6-volume set on very in-depth Talmudic study on a few particular tractates, and concerning which I particularly remember being a bar mitzvah boy and thinking that, you know, someone had gotten off with just giving me books. And years later in yeshiva, when I started studying these Sfarim, and I really began to appreciate them, so I happened to be studying the first volume, and I opened up the cover, and there was an inscription to me from the person who bought it for me. So I wrote them a thank you note. I said, you know, I imagine after my bar mitzvah, I wrote you a thank you note, because I wrote everybody thank you notes, but I didn't really appreciate what you'd given me. So you should know that now I'm in yeshiva, and I've been here now 2 years, and I'm really into this, and I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying the book that you got me, whatever. So they wrote me back a letter, you know, sometimes you only appreciate things later in life. But anyway, so in the yeshiva world, they published this in a 2-volume set, like this, right? Which is much smaller print, because people keep it on their desk. It's such a reference volume. You'll see, if you come into my office, I have a 4-volume Talmud. A whole Talmud and 4 also little volumes. And that's what every yeshiva guy has on his desk. 4 volumes of Talmud, 2 volumes of Rambam. You know, so when I'm learning, I need the Rambam. I look up the Rambam, and that's what it is. It gets to be so common that each of the 14 books, right, has different sections. For example, the first book is Mada, which deals with Jewish philosophy. The second is Ava, which is called love. Mada is knowledge, the book of knowledge. Second is called love. Third is called times. Like, for example, the book of times will have the laws of Shabbat. It'll have the laws of the holidays. It'll have the laws, you know, whatever it is, right? So sometimes you forget where a particular section of laws is within a particular unit. Like, for example, the laws of sacrifice, are they in the book called Kedusha, holiness, because of the Beit HaMikdash, right, Kadosh? Or are they in the book called Korbanot, sacrifices? Or are they in the book called Avodah? So what a lot of guys in Shiva do is they make themselves a little list inside, like in the front cover. And the reason they put it in here is because this way I can look up right away and I can find where the particular laws are. All right, about the Rambam's Yad HaChazaka that we mentioned before. I want to tell you, by the way, that this should no mean imply that this is a more important work, although in certain ways it was, than the Guide to the Perplexed. It's just that the Guide to the Perplexed is pretty much self-explanatory. If you decide to study it, you can read it, you won't have a problem. This needs a little bit of an introduction. First of all, and I want to do 2 things. I want to tell you a little bit, just in passing, about how it works. I'd like to show you how the given page works, and then I'd like to learn a halacha with you. Now, it's interesting that it's interesting that the first section of this book, remember, this is a magnum opus of halacha, of Jewish law. And it contains within it, broken down into sections, all of Jewish law according to the Rambam. How would you expect such a work to begin? I mean, what would you begin with? Now, if you look at the Talmud, so the Talmud begins with a tractate called Brachot. Or in the yeshiva world, Brachos. And Brachot, ostensibly, despite, you know, obviously we noted the other day that it's not so simple, but Brachot deals with the laws of blessings, and that makes a lot of sense. I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do, traditionally as a Jew, is to bless God. The Talmud is making a tremendous statement that I begin my day with an act of recognition, of thanksgiving, hodaya. Very important, the concept of hodaya, of appreciating what I have and what I've been given and how much potential and what I can do with it. So that's how I would have expected the Rambam to go. I would have expected the Rambam to say, okay, the Talmud begins with brachot, I'll begin with brachot. Not so.
The Rambam begins with what I expected the Talmud to begin with. The law is known as Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. The first book is called the Book of Knowledge, and the first section of laws is called the laws of the foundation of Torah, the basis of Torah. And this is really a work of philosophy. It's a philosophical treatise, broken down into halachot. Is there an obligation to believe in God? Is there an obligation to accept that God is one? In fact, much of the 13 principles of the Rambam that I mentioned before are found in this first section of halacha. Now, there are a number of issues here. First and foremost is that the Rambam views Jewish philosophy as part and parcel of halacha. I have a halachic obligation to attempt to understand God. That's a tremendous idea. We would have thought, and I meet people like this all the time, well, there's philosophy, and then there's halacha. So I live, remember, now we're in yeshiva, I live in the yeshiva world, so I'm studying Gemara, I'm studying halacha, so I don't have time for all this philosophy mumbo-jumbo, is there a God, why do I, God, I want to know what to do. How do I keep Shabbos? How do I pray? Okay, how do I do it? Leave me alone! So the Rambam, who was an arch halachicist, he says, slow down. Take it easy. What does it mean? Where's the value in it? What do you glean from it? Who is God? If you think that you're going to go and make Kiddush on Friday night without knowing who you're making Kiddush to, and that you're going to be able to fulfill the commandment to make Kiddush the way you should, you're whistling Dixie. If you really want to fulfill the halacha of Kiddush, first you have to think about who you're making Kiddush to. What are you trying to sanctify? And when you read these halachot, they're magnificent. There's a halacha to understand the mitzvah. And part of the fulfillment of the technical detail of the law is the appreciation of what the meaning of that law is. That's a tremendous idea. It's interesting, by the way, that if you look at the whole sum total of this work, he begins with the philosophical question of, is there a God? Which we'll get to in a minute. He concludes all the way at the end of Sefer Melachim, which is in the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. So the laws of Melachim, the laws of kings. So what are the laws of kings? Well, the laws of kings are all about how you anoint a king, when you anoint a king, what it means to have a king. Now, when do I anoint a king? I mean, the Rambam is writing this in the Middle Ages to the people who lived in Spain, in Egypt. And he's telling them, listen, let's discuss the laws of what to do when there's a king. What do I need that for? Why is that important? If you look through the laws of the Rambam, by the way, you'll find all sorts of laws like that. The Rambam was not doing what the Chafetz Chaim was doing. The Rambam has a section of laws on the temple. Listen, if you're walking into the temple and you're a priest, and you're not sure when you're in mourning whether you're supposed to do this or that, how do you offer up a whole burnt offering? Listen, if you commit a transgression, you should know you're liable to bring a transgression offering. How do you do that? What kind of a calf? How old does the calf has to be? And I'm sitting here in medieval Spain, and I'm thinking to myself, get off my back. You know, get a life. I mean, I got a deal tomorrow morning with that. I earn a living. What do I care how to offer? If the temple gets rebuilt, and they tell me to bring a calf, so you'll give me a quick... Ram says, no. And the Rambam says no from two perspectives. First of all, he says no because one of his 13 principles is that you should believe that redemption can come. And second of all, he says no because if the sum total of Judaism is designed to make the world a better place, and if my relationship with Judaism, with Torah, with Halakha, is designed to make me a better person, then every aspect of that Torah is crucial in the process of my becoming a better human being. So that even if I can't fulfill the halakha, studying it, understanding its value is nonetheless incredibly important in terms of the messages that it gives me. I'll give you one example. There's a very strange halakha of how to build an altar. Right? If I have a temple, and we're going to build an altar to offer up, so how do you build an altar? So your immediate response, well, who cares how you build an altar? The Torah goes into it. And the Rambam includes it in his work of halacha. You're not allowed to build an altar out of hewn stone, right? I can't take an iron instrument and hew, that's a great word, hew, right? I can't hew stone. Chatziva, it's called in Hebrew. I can't do that. Why? Because if an altar has had an iron instrument, which is usually an instrument of war, taken to it, it can no longer be effective as a means of bringing me closer to God. That is a tremendous idea. So it may be that, practically speaking, I'm not going to build an altar this afternoon. I hope I will, but I don't think so. But that doesn't mean that philosophically there's a world to be learned from that. That Jewish altars are not built with instruments of war. That a person has to know. That doesn't mean there isn't a mitzvah of war. If someone comes to kill you, you actually have a mitzvah to go to war. I believe personally in 1948, and I very much think this was the Rambam's opinion, in 1948, when Jews put on uniform and went to war, they were fulfilling a biblical commandment. And the Rambam defines what a mitzvah of a war is. If there is a nation that rises up against the Jewish people in their land, and possibly even not in their land, and attempts to destroy them, then the Jewish people as a nation have the right, the obligation, to stand up and defend themselves. That you have an obligation to protect other Jewish lives in the event that you can do so. And that's a fulfillment of an obligation. But that doesn't mean that you don't pay a price for that. King David never built the temple. Because God said, your hands are spilled with blood. You've been a warrior. A warrior can't build a temple. Now that's an unbelievable idea. We're talking about King David. We're talking about the person who wrote the Psalms. We're talking about a person who spoke with God. You know, he like daily schmoozes with God. How you doing? How's the weather? Here's a psalm. I mean, and he couldn't build the temple? That's an incredible idea. And the implications of that, when you study it, are very far-reaching. If as a King David, I can be so affected by being in a war that I can't build a temple, I have to recognize how much the events in my life affect me. Don't think that if you put yourself in a certain environment, it doesn't affect you. Very powerful. I'll give you an example. I remember when I first started doing reserve duty, Miluim. So we had, it was a very difficult period of time. And to be honest, at the time, I remember I got out of regular army and I'd been in Lebanon, I'd been in a war. And I thought, you know, the worst is behind me. They pulled out down below Lebanon. They were now only in the security zone. I had a year not doing the army because you get a sort of a year, almost a year, whatever. And I thought reserve duty, you know, it'll be fun. I mean, I wasn't married yet. I didn't have children yet. So it was like a vacation from what I was doing, you know what? Anyway, unfortunately, the Intifada started like 3 months earlier. So that there went all the fun. So we found ourselves in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, in a place called Jabalia, which is a refugee camp in Gaza, and it was a less than pleasant experience. And I had there were some very difficult experiences, and it was very challenging. I was a young officer, you know, relative. And it's funny, it's like when you finish grade school in eighth grade, and then you go to high school in ninth grade. So in eighth grade, right, you're a king. Because you're the eighth grader. Then you go to high school, you're a freshie, right? You have to start all over again. And the same thing to a certain extent happens at the end of high school. You know, you're a king, you're a senior. You go to college, you're a freshman, right? And this is, I guess, the experience of life. So when you finish Sadir, when you finish regular army, so you're already like a second in command of a company, and you've been in the army a few years, and you've been around, and the younger soldiers are asking you questions about your experiences. Then you go to Miluim, and you're in charge of soldiers for whom, you know, when they were inducted into the army, it was a good year for milk for you. I mean, I had soldiers who joined the army in 1963, which is the year I was born. So you can imagine it's a challenge to command and to give orders to such soldiers, and ultimately you have to get them to listen to you because they want to, and not because you command them. That's the challenge. But okay. So we were in difficult situations. So at the end of this whole month period of intifada and riots and stonings and everything else, so they made a big party. I remember I thought at the time they were making this party specifically because we'd gotten through that month. I've learned since that they do this every time they finish a Miluim. Sometimes they do it when they start a Miluim. Sometimes they do it in the middle of Miluim. You know, whatever an excuse is for a party, right? And they had a big party and everybody who wasn't on patrol got together and they broke out a couple of bottles, whatever. And when I got to this unit, so there were only like one or two other guys who called themselves, you know my hesitations about defining religion, but who called themselves religious with kippot, whatever. And mostly it was a self-defined, at least secular unit. And this was a challenge for me. But by the end of this month, I had gotten very close. You know, you get very close sometimes very quickly in situations like that. So by the end of the month, you know, they had already dubbed me like the rabbi of the unit. and they had me on Friday night making kiddush for the whole, you know, whoever wasn't on patrol, and I would give a Dvar Torah at the meal, you know, this sort of thing. So at the final party, so first of all, they made an attempt, because this wasn't something sponsored by the army, we did it on our own. So they decided for the first time they were going to get kosher meat. Because they wanted me to be able to eat, you know, so they wanted to know where they came to me, where can they buy the meat, etc. Do I keep glatt, you know, whatever it might be, right? So they got kosher meat, and which I was amazed by, because it was actually a little more expensive in the circumstances, because they could have just gotten to an Arab, bought a cow, bought a sheep, killed it, and whatever. And at the party, they asked me, you know, to make a l'chaim and give a dvar Torah, whatever, and I was really into it. And at the end of this whole evening, right, so a van pulls up. This was like the summation of the party. And the van opens its back doors, and they pull out a screen, and they start showing a porno movie. That's what you do. You finish your miluim, you have a party, you show a porno movie. So needless to say, I didn't stay for the porno movie. I made my excuses and I left. And after a year or so, they stopped showing the porno movies. Going to miluim, on the one hand, is a magnificent experience. And it's an educational experience. And it gives you an opportunity to meet people you might not normally meet. And to reflect on opinions that you might not normally come in contact with. And there are no lines in reserve duty units. You know, there was once a suggestion that the ultra-Orthodox be an ultra-Orthodox unit. And there's a big problem with this in terms of Hezde units. It's not a good thing. It's a wonderful thing, to a certain extent, in the army, that you have left-wingers and right-wingers and religious and irreligious, and everybody's all together in one melting pot. And so on the one hand, it's a magnificent experience. But don't think that at the end of a month, in an environment like that, it doesn't affect you. If every night you're sitting in your tent and you're listening to dirty jokes, and if you're with the kind of guys who show porno flicks, who are telling about their various conquests out of the home, etc., that affects you. And it doesn't mean, God forbid, that I judge those people. But it affects you. And sometimes it's less obvious, and sometimes it's more obvious. And so King David is told, you've been affected, whether you realize it or not, you can't build a mikdash. The Rambam includes that in his system of halacha, because he believes that that's as valuable and as important a message as what we're actually doing. And the last section that the Rambam includes are his Book of Kings. Because what does it mean to have a king? It means redemption. It means, and he discusses this in his Laws of Kings as well as in his Guide to the Perplexed, that there will ultimately be a time when we won't wonder whether there's a God, where it will become clearer that there is a God. You won't have to ask, where is God? You'll just have to ask, what do you want of me? And that time the Rambam associates with what we call redemption, when the Jewish people return to their homeland, when the temple is built, when a king is anointed, and the family of David is reestablished, when there's peace on earth. So the Rambam begins his book, his magnum opus of halacha, with a detailing of the philosophical questions with regards to God, and ends his magnum opus with the Laws of Kings, when God will be apparent, because the journey in halacha, according to the Rambam, is a journey in the appreciation of God. The challenge of halakha, according to the Rambam, of Jewish law, is an attempt, through a system, to come closer to that thing that we call Hashem. And says the Rambam, how do you become closer to God? How do you develop a relationship with God? You know, the most important stage that a person can reach is to decide that they want to develop a relationship with God. I've heard people call this the atheist question. You know, I don't know if there is a God or there isn't a God. But if there's a God, then I'd like to get to know you. I'd like an introduction. Really not an atheist, an agnostic, but okay. How do you get a relationship with God, even if you decide you think there might be a God? Well, how do you develop a relationship with anybody? How do I develop a relationship with my wife? How do I develop a relationship with my children? How do I develop a relationship with you? A relationship comes as a result of shared experiences. If I work in a place, and there's four floors, and we're all working in the same company, but I never go to the third floor and they never come down to the second, then I don't have a relationship with that person. In order to have a relationship, we have to have shared experiences. So it comes along and the Rambam says, this is the total of shared experience. If you want to develop a relationship with Hashem, share in the experience. Because in sharing that experience, in contemplating those philosophical, those ethical, those theological questions, then you will be able to relate to God. The longer I'm married to my wife, the more experience I share with you, the more I attempt to understand her, which is a challenge. This is on tape, right? The more I attempt to understand my wife, the closer I become with her. It's that struggle. It isn't a given. It's especially true with children. We take it for granted. We're the adult. We understand everything. Sometimes our children come up with things we can't even begin to imagine. It's amazing. My daughter the other day was talking to me about death. Where she gets this from? And you can have a philosophical discussion with a 7-year-old. I remember once I was annoyed with Dorit about something. I don't remember what it was. Right? So I snapped at her. So, like a day later, you know, there's no big deal not to argue. That's not real. Right? The real challenge is how you make up. My granny, actually, my grandmother from England, she passed away a few years ago. Amazing, amazing individual. She died at 94. She said before we got married, she said, I'm going to give you one piece of advice. Don't ever go to sleep angry. That was her piece of advice to me. Now, somebody gives you lots of advice, but if somebody gives you one piece of advice, then you take it seriously. It's a very clever thing. That was her piece of advice to all of her grandchildren before they got married. So I determined to keep this piece of advice. I have never, Baruch Hashem, gone to sleep angry. So that means sometimes you have to stay up till 3 a.m, but you don't go to sleep angry. That attempt, that challenge, so I snapped at my wife one day, whatever. So the next day, Yonatan, my son, you know, and he saw me snap. He didn't see we made up. So he sits in the car. He says, you don't yell at Ima. If you yell at Ima, I will have to hit you. I mean, this is like a 3-year-old. It's amazing. And you share an experience like that with somebody, you become closer with them. That's what this is. How do I come close to Hashem? How do I develop a relationship with God? Not as a God who's a master, not as a God who's omnipotent, not as a God who's universal and unlimited. Because that's maybe knowledge that I need in order to develop a relationship with God. But how do I develop a relationship with God? I can't develop a relationship with someone who's omnipotent. Hey, omnipotent one, let's go bowling. It doesn't work. I have to get to know that God. It has to become personal. I have to believe that when I'm blowing a shofar, it's an act of love. I have to feel that when I'm making Kiddush on Shabbat, when I bring my child over and give them a blessing, that that's a function of my relationship with Hashem. And so when I finish that meal, I feel more. I relate more. That's what halacha is according to the Rambam. Now having said that, let's go to the next stage. Let's take a look at a halacha in the Rambam. Just to give you a taste of how it works. And I love this. I want to tell you, this is... Now we're really learning. This is tremendous. Now, so this is the first section of halachot. It's called Sefer Hamada. And whenever you see Sefer Hamada, and by the way, I should point out one more thing, which is that in every of these two-volume Rambams, you will find a section which details all these books. Now, I've never really gone through the English translation, so I don't know if you find this in the English translation, right? But this is a great thing to study. If somebody's going to study Rambam, they're a beginner, they don't know. So you get a chavruta, you get somebody, and you study this. It's like 4 or 5 pages. It goes through each section of the Rambam, right? The first book is called Mada. The second book is called X. And then he goes back and he says, okay, now these are the sections of laws containing in these books. The first is the Yesodei Torah, and the second is the laws of character traits. Rambam has a whole set of halachot. How to develop yourself characteristic. How to make yourself a better person. If I'm angry too much, how do I make myself better? So he gives you a system. This is what you have to do. Halachically speaking, it's unbelievable. Psychology. He says if you're at one extreme, you got to go over to the other extreme. And then you end up back in the middle. Which, by the way, is very true. If you're a person who gets stepped on all the time, which is not a good thing, so you got to go over to the other extreme. Because eventually you find yourself in the middle and vice versa. If you're too angry, just give. Just be kind. Just be disgustingly, sickeningly good. And eventually you'll end up in the middle. And if you want to know how the system works, so you can look up and see. And the Rambam says why he wrote each section. Why he wrote this book first and that book second and this book third. Why within each book he wrote this order of halachot. For example, I'll give you one example. Where do I find the laws of prayer? Laws of prayer. So I would think, where would I find the laws of prayer? In the book called Zmanim, Times. Because I have set time, times for prayer. That's not where you find it. You find it in the book called Ahava, Love. Because prayer, according to the Rambam, was an act of love. And you learn tremendous things just from how the Rambam, he was an organizer par excellence. Magnificent the way he does this. So now you look at the first halacha, and you've already got a sense of what this book is about, and its philosophy, whatever else it is. And he says, okay, this is the Sefer Amada, the book of knowledge, and this is the first book. And then he says, okay, Hilchotav Chamesh. Now this is very important. This is called a koteret. Don't worry if you don't remember the word, but it means headline. This is like a headline. People don't generally look at the headline in the Rambam. They go straight to the halacha. And they're missing something very important, because the Rambam wrote that headline. And you can learn a lot from how the Rambam describes what you're going to find. Sometimes he describes it in a word that's difficult to understand, and that leads to a whole discussion on what he means. So the Rambam says, there are five halachot, and these are those halachot, five sets of halachot, halachot yesodei ha-Torah, halachot ha-Torah, and he goes through five sections, the laws of Talmud Torah, the laws of non-Jews and idol worshippers, how do I relate to them, when do I relate to them, when do I not relate to them, when am I worried that the influence that idolatry will have on me precludes my being able to relate to them, when am I not? And then the laws of tshuva, of repentance. I give you a whole lecture just on why he groups these five together. It's unbelievable. Then he gets into Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. So you see at the beginning of a book, you have two bold headlines. Okay, and now he does the same thing. Now this is very interesting. He says, what do you want to know when you come to a work of halacha? What do you want to know? There's a thing called Torah tidbits. I don't know if you've ever seen this in the synagogue. If you went to a synagogue, there's this little thing that the NCSY Center pulls out. And it's tremendous. And it's like little, they have like SDTs, they call them, Short Divrei Torah. It's cute. And at the beginning of this little booklet that they put out, this little thing, I'll bring one in. They have Torah stats. The stats, the statistics of this week's parasha. You know, when I was a kid, so we were into baseball, basketball, right? So he had stats. How many home runs did he hit? You know, how many of his home runs, you know, were out of left field? What's his ERA, his average, you know? So they have Torah stats. How many verses are there? How many chapters are there? You know, where does it stand? This is the third largest portion in verses, but the sixth largest portion in how many mitzvot does it have? This is the second largest portion in mitzvot. It's the third largest. However, mitzvah per pasuk stats are lower because they're more, you know, like these type of things. And I look at this and I'm thinking like, okay, first of all, what computer geek takes the time to do this? Right? And who cares? But then I was talking to somebody in the synagogue, and they said, you know, this is really interesting. And I'm thinking like, what's interesting? This is really cool. This week's parsha is like the second most mitzvot for pasuk in the Torah. And I was looking at it and saying like, yeah, okay, right? He's like, no, that's really cool. So he starts looking in and he starts seeing the different mitzvot. So I realized that different people come to things in different ways. So the Rambam begins by saying, what are the mitzvot in this section of laws? So he says, there are 10 mitzvot. There's 6 positive commandments and 4 negative commandments. So right away you know that in studying this first section of laws, which is all about Jewish philosophy, so you're saying to yourself, well, wait a second, I want to get to the meat. So the Rambam says, no. You get 10 mitzvot in this section of laws. This section of laws, beginning here, goes till here, right? That's what you're talking about, right? You could go through this. I want you to know, if you do a few different halachot, a few different laws a day, so at the end of a couple of weeks, you've covered this. 10 mitzvot, it's not bad. I mean, if you've got 613 mitzvot, when you think about it, that's like, 1.5%, 2%, I don't know, I'm not good at those things, right? So that's good. Okay. And there are 6 positive, 4 negative. Okay, so now he goes into what they are. And he lists the 10 mitzvot. The first one is to know there's a God. The second one is that you shouldn't assume that there's any other God. The third is to make God unique, whatever that means. The fourth is to love God. This one always blows me away. If you have to know there's a God, and we'll get to that in a second, and if you have to accept that there's only one God, then why do you also have a mitzvah to love God? Very interesting. People make a mistake. They think that, you know, if somebody has a negative perception of God, it's because they don't know there's a God. It took me a long time to realize as an educator that's not true. In fact, very often if a person has no knowledge of God, they also have no opinion of God. Very often a person who has a negative perception of God, it's because they've already considered the possibility there is a God. And they're not denying that there could be a God. They're just denying whether that God is good. Do I want to love that God? And because of that, we do the flip. We assume that once we've discovered that there is a God, that that necessarily assumes that we will now love God. That's not so true. I was once having a discussion with an educator who I have a lot of respect for. And he works in a program here in the Old City, which deals very much with, you know, educating and reaching out to students who have very little background. And the whole thrust of this particular institution is to prove that there's a God. So I've told you that I have my, you know, personal qualms about whether or not you can prove that there's a God. And I've told you that I don't think that that means that you can't know that there's a God. I just think that the issue is not proof. But beyond proving God, the real question is, even if I could prove to you that there's a God, so what? So what? Let's say I proved to you that there's a God. I mean, I proved to myself at a certain point that there was a God. And I personally feel that I know that there's a God. But that doesn't mean I can ever prove it to you. But let's say I could. So what? So fine, there's a God. Have a nice day. Very good. So, what does that do? I mean, does it make a difference in your life? Is it relevant? And that's a very dangerous thing. That you walk away knowing there's a God with an assumption that now you'll love God. Who says that so? And I want you to know, it's not so difficult to discover that there is a God. And again, don't anybody misunderstand me here. I'm not saying that's what you have to do. I'm sharing with you where I'm coming from. It's very difficult to learn to love God. It's a tremendous challenge. If you can achieve it, and you don't, it's not sort of something you either are there or you're not. It's a process which I don't think you ever end in this world. You can love God more, you can love God less. You can hate God more, you can hate God less. Elie Wiesel once said, a Jew can affirm God, he can deny God, but he can never ignore God. Which is, I think, a very powerful statement. That's what the Rambam is saying here. It's interesting that the Rambam doesn't begin by saying, V'ahavta t'Hashem Elokecha, you should love the Lord thy God. He says, first know that there's a God. Decide what God is. How do you love something if you don't know what it is? Then decide that there's only one God. I'll give you maybe a modern day equivalent. We have many gods. We think that idolatry is a thing in the past. If you look at how people relate to the Ten Commandments. So some of the commandments, you know, not so difficult. They tell a story about a rabbi in a shul who was going through the Ten Commandments the week that it was read. You know, you have to believe in God. You shouldn't steal. You shouldn't murder, right? You shouldn't commit adultery. You shouldn't covet. You shouldn't lie, right? And they overheard two guys leaving the synagogue that morning. You know, well, at least we don't, you know, at least we don't worship idols. You know, that's not so true. We have lots of idols. When you think about it, an idol to a certain extent is anything which converts the means to the ends. If I assume that something which is a vehicle is really the end goal. So on an ancient level, I take the sun, which is a vehicle that's given to me to appreciate the world, and I assume that it's the end, that it's the object of worship. And so if I take anything which is really a means to achieve things in this world, and I make of it an end, then that's a form of idolatry. Whether halachically, technically, that's exactly what these laws discuss. But certainly philosophically. Well, money can be an idol. How many times have you met someone who actually made it? And they're still trying to get there. Like, what amount of money is enough? You know, you ever have the fantasy? Everybody has the fantasy. If I win the lottery. Well, if I win the lottery, for how much? Like, I don't know about you, but most people that I've ever talked to about this particular fantasy, you know, you have this kind of discussion. If you won the lottery, you won $1 million, right? They say, well, if I won $1 million, I give 10% to charity. Okay. And I put $100,000 each away for the kids, you know, for the future. Okay. And then maybe, you know, $100,000, open up a yeshiva. Maybe another $100,000, you know, give to my wife, buy anything you want. You know, right? Fine. Then you start thinking, you know, no, I'll tell you what. If I won $5 million, because hey, a million, hey, fine. How much is enough? And people get there, and they have so much money, and all of a sudden they say, wait a second. What's all this money for? What did I make all this money for? What do I do with it? Where am I going? So it's interesting that the Rambam says, before you can develop a relationship of love with God, you have to deal with certain other issues first. Having said this, and that's just one little nitpicking detail that I pull out of the title, before I ever get to the first halacha, and there are whole commentaries written on the titles of the Rambam. Now I get to the first halacha. What's the first halacha? Yisod HaYisodot, V'Amud HaChochmot, one of the bases, one of the pillars of wisdom, to know that there is a God. Leida SheYesham Matzui V'Shem. To know that there's a God. And he goes on what that means, to believe that God created everything, and that everything here is a result of God. Okay, ask me a question. Now we're learning. Ask me a question. Okay, I open up this book. The first halakha that I come to in the Rambam is that the basis of Judaism, the pillar of wisdom on which everything stands, right, is to know that there is a God. By the way, the Rambam in his Sefer HaMitzvot, in his Book of Commandments, and by the way, you can find a little abridged version of the Sefer HaMitzvot here. It's called the Minyan HaMitzvot. It just lists all the mitzvot. It's like 2 pages. So the first mitzvah is Mitzvah Rishona, the first mitzvah, maybe mitzvot to say of the positive commandments, Leida, to know Sheyesh Hashem Elohah, that there's a God. Sheneemar, because it says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord thy God. So I have a mitzvah to know that there's a God. Anybody have a question? How could you? Ridiculous! I mean, I bring a guy, and I say, listen, you know, I'd love to teach you about the beauty of Judaism. So the guy said, well, you know, Judaism, I don't know, whatever. But you know, I've heard this thing, there's 613 mitzvot, right? So maybe I'll take a look at mitzvot, and I say, oh, great idea. Great idea. Every day study a different mitzvah. Take a week on each mitzvah, no problem. When you feel, you know, you've got mitzvot, whatever, I don't know, study tzitzit. And study what tzitzit is, and what the beauty of tzitzit is. Study tefillin, study candle lighting on Friday afternoon. Study kiddush, study making motzi. Study, I don't know, study whatever you want. When you get one mitzvah down and you feel you develop a relationship with it, it's meaningful to you, then go to another mitzvah. And instead of trying to find God, just discover mitzvah and you'll find God on your own. Okay, great. So he's all excited about this. Oh, it's tremendous. I want to get to know Judaism, Jewish heritage. Right? So I open up the book. First mitzvah. No, there's a God. Thank you. Have a nice day. How do I do that? How can you command somebody to know there's a God? I mean, that's a psychological state. Either you believe there's a God, in which case you don't need the commandment, or you don't, in which case it doesn't make a difference if there is a commandment. And by the way, there's a principle we have in the Talmud that we're not asked to do anything in the Torah that we're not capable of doing. That's a tremendous idea. It means essentially that every human being is capable of discovering God. And by the way, it's important to mention this because there's a common mistake that people make in attempting to do what I described before. See, we're used to a certain mathematical series of equations. So we assume that when you build blocks, so that's what you do. You build the first level, and then you build the second level, and there's truth to that in many different systems, including Judaism. But sometimes you have to realize that you can't accomplish A without going through B, C, D, and E. You can get an idea of what A is supposed to be, but that doesn't mean you're going to get there. When I study Torah, if I stop and say, I'm going to answer this question, then I'm ready for the next one, I'll never get anywhere. Never get anywhere. Because what if you can't answer that question? You're studying the story of Yishmael, and you have some really good questions. So you stop and you think about it. What if you don't have an answer? So then you say, okay, I'll try the opposite way. And you keep learning. And you have lots and lots of questions. And the questions amass. And you write them down in notebooks. And gradually as you learn, you come across something and you say, you know, this answers that question I once had. I know, for example, if you read the Abarbanel, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel was a magnificent commentator. He lived in the 1400s. He was exiled from Spain. He was actually one of the ministers of the king and queen of Spain, Queen Isabella. They offered him a pardon. They offered him to stay in Spain in the Spanish Inquisition, despite the fact that all the Jews were leaving, and to grant him special citizenship without converting to Christianity. He refused. He quoted, actually, it's interesting, he quoted to Queen Isabella the famous verse from the Book of Ruth. Amecha mi, whither thou goest, I will go. These are my people. I can't be here if they're there. And so he leads 80,000 Jews across the border into Portugal in August of 1492. He has a magnificent commentary on the Torah. And the way his commentary works is that he asks a whole series of questions. And then he gives you a treatise. And as he's giving you the treatise, he says, oh, by the way, this answers the third question. And he keeps talking. He says, this answers the first question. And then he says, and this answers the sixth question. So I thought, oh, this is great, because this is me. This is like how I love to learn. I love to ask questions and give answers. I thought, me and the Abarbanel would be great. And I really fell in love with the Abarbanel until I started to realize that he doesn't answer all his questions. He'll ask 13 questions, he'll give a treatise, you'll get 11, you'll be left with 2 questions. So someone finally said to me, well, have you read through the entire Abarbanel? So I said, no. He said, well, who says the Abarbanel answers the question in Exodus that he asks in Exodus? Maybe he answers it in Genesis. Maybe when you're studying the book of Deuteronomy all the way at the end, you'll figure out one of the questions that he asked in... So I said, okay, this is great. It's a challenge, but it's great, and I enjoy the Abarbanel. I'll do it. So I went through the entire Abarbanel. Every week, on the portion of the week, that year, I studied the Abarbanel, and I went through the whole Abarbanel. And I did it systematically, and I went through, and I had questions, and I had answers, whatever. And I found I finished the entire 5 books of the Abarbanel. And I had a sense, doesn't mean I remembered every detail, that there were still a lot of questions. I mean, I had some that just weren't answered. And I spent time looking for them, whatever. It took me a while to realize that even though he hadn't answered all his questions, the questions didn't bother me anymore. Because I'd studied the entire Abarbanel. It's a tremendous idea. That's very important in the Rambam. It takes a lifetime to work on this first mitzvah. What the Rambam is saying, though, is that this first mitzvah is the guideline that's in the back of your mind as you go through my work. As you live life in this world, as I walk out in the park and I look out at this magnificent view, there's a question in the back of my mind. What does this do for me? How do I relate to God by virtue of what I'm doing? How do I create that relationship and allow it to grow through what I'm doing looking out this window? And as every experience in my life contributes to my relationship with Hashem, then I know God in a way today that I didn't even contemplate God last week. So if you ask me, okay, have you reached the conclusion? There is no conclusion. That's why the Rambam finishes his whole work of halakha with the book of the laws of kings, of the messianic age, of the world to come, of resurrection, of all these difficult concepts, because perhaps you can't really conclude it in this world. Your challenge is not to get there. Your challenge is what you do along the way. How far you get, what you succeed in accomplishing, how much of a better person you become. And that's the Rambam's work of halakha. And I can only tell you, there's actually the Lavitcher Rebbe suggested that people study a certain number, I forget if it's one portion or two, one chapter, of Rambam every day. The act of studying Rambam, of studying halakha in an organized fashion, is not just a technical know-how. It's not just studying the torts and knowing legalistic syndromes. It's much more about discovering the beauty of Jewish life. The composite of the entire Jewish experience. And all of this the Rambam gave us. And that's why if you go up to Tiberias, to Tveria, and you look at the Rambam's grave, it says there, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, lo kam ke Moshe. There's a famous verse in the Torah, lo kam ke Moshe navi, od bi Israel, there was never and never will be another prophet in Israel like Moshe. So somebody did a play on it and said, from Moses to Moses, from Moshe till Moses Maimonides, there was never another Moshe. In other words, Moshe Maimonides was unique. And I want you to know something, one last thought. When I learn Rambam, I'm not studying the works of someone who lived in the past, in the 12th century. The Rambam becomes my chavusa. If you listen to Jews talk about the Rambam, about Rashi, and you'll hear me say it in class, they don't say, Rashi said, the Rambam said. They say, Rambam says. That's not because of some, you know, linguistic Yiddishist exile mentality. It's because when I study Rambam, the Rambam comes alive. And the Rambam is sitting here in this Beis Medrash. You can never be alone in this Beis Medrash. Because in this room, while we're sitting here, there's a whole other group of people sitting here with us. And when we walk in the door in the morning to sit down and learn Torah, then Rashi walks in with us, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi walks in with us, and the Rambam walks in with us, and Rabbi Akiva is walking in with us, and there's an echo, and they're screaming at each other, and they're debating. And that's why when you get into Rambam, and you're learning Rambam, and you're trying to figure out how could the Rambam say this, then you get a little lost in it. And that's the beauty of studying Rambam. So I told you, I hope that this whet your appetite. it's obviously not at all conclusive or complete in terms of a picture of who the Rambam was and what the Rambam gave us. But if you walk away with a little more of an appreciation of who the Rambam was and what he gave us, and perhaps a little bit of an appetite at some point in your lives, next week, next month, next year, whenever it might be, to open up a Rambam and have some fun, then I'll be happy and yours is the earth.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.